This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, Irirangi Tumotu, MPR. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. MPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out mpr.nz for more information.
Kia ora and welcome to Reserved Recommendations. This is a show about great trash, difficult art, and our complicated relationships with art and culture. My name's Hugh, I'm the host of the show, and I'd like to take this opportunity to put in a very mild content warning for the show as a whole. Sometimes our recommendations on this show are reserved just because the thing that we're discussing is in some way not good, but sometimes there are aspects of the art or artist that may be confronting for some people. Check the episode descriptions for more information, and do be aware of your listening environment. Kia ora everybody, we are once again in solo mini-sode land, because while I am working on it, I am working on many other things at the same time, and I do not have a guest. I want to try and keep some momentum going, so we are here in solo mini-sode land. I hope you will bear with me. What I'd like to do is expand a little bit on some of the thoughts that I was having last episode, although in a bit of a less personal and a more general kind of way, because I have some reckons about where certain factions in our politics would like things to go, and they're not radically counter, but somewhat counter to some prevailing narratives. And I think, you know, it's worth putting my oar in and putting my two cents into the world. So, as a little bit of background on where this has all come from, I'm going to go way, way back in time, and I promise this is going somewhere. So, in the high and far off times when the world was new and all, before I went off to be much, much better at being an audio engineering student, I was a not especially distinguished humanities student. I was studying both classics and philosophy at the University of Otago. And as one does in the early stages of a philosophy degree, which is, to be clear, not a thing that I have, we looked at the social philosophy of Hobbes. Now, if you're not familiar with Hobbes, the very, 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 very brief version of his kind of grand idea. So what he was interested in was, why should we have a government and why should we do what it says? And Hobbes's thesis, the end point of the idea that he comes to, is that in a state of nature, so by that he means in a situation where there is no sort of law or sovereignty governing human behavior, human life would be nasty, brutish, and short. He characterizes it as a war of all against all. And so he suggests that the way out of that situation would be to serve a sovereign, serve a state, and receive its protection and its governance in return. And I think a critique of Hobbes is that you can't really exist in a state of nature for very long. Human beings are group operators. That's how we have survived and evolved over the years. A human by themselves is not especially effective. A group of organized humans can do all kinds of things which, even without modern technology, so thinking about, you know, the stereotypical caveman, if you like, if you want to be very broad. The thing that allows a group of humans to predate on animals much larger and more physically imposing on them. Again, stereotypically, we hunted the mammoth, right? Just sticking with really broad concepts. The thing that lets us do that is organization. We can team up, we can have one group of people act as a distraction, one group of people set a trap. All of this stuff that is impossible for a single person to do. Now, I promise that this is going somewhere, but I have been reading a lot of fiction lately, which inadvertently, this was not a thing I set out to do, but has been kind of post-apocalyptic in nature. And it's been very interesting because the newer the post-apocalyptic fiction is, the more that it's about the ways in which that tendency towards organization expresses itself in the aftermath of some sort of collapse. What we might think of as a more stereotypical apocalyptic fantasy, the idea of like a very small group of people kind of defending themselves against a hostile world, that's a much more archaic, I guess, fictional concept. It doesn't really come up as often these days. And I think that's very interesting. So we'll return to the fiction, I promise, because I think that the fiction maybe gives us some clues about the way out of the situation that I'm about to describe. But what all of this led me to thinking about was when I talked about Winston Peters, I think that Winston Peters is probably fascist, but I think that he's fascist without necessarily knowing that he's fascist. I don't know how accurate that is now that I've said it, but he's fascist because what he wants is to be in charge. And there is no ideological consistency to him. He'll say whatever he thinks he needs to say. And he'll cheerfully say fairly contradictory things reasonably close together. And then just stick with whichever of those appears to have got the best reaction. And if you look at fascist leaders throughout history, that's a very fascist way to behave. Fascists, we think of them as rigid and unbending, but fascists actually make up a lot of stuff ad hoc because fascism is never a particularly coherent political ideology. It's really focused on vibes. And so that's a turn that we're seeing in international politics, right? We're seeing an ascendant populist right, and that's kind of fascist. But I want to stop for a second, and I want to look at the other side of the right-wing coalition that's in power. Because I don't think that they're really interested in fascism. And I think that they're perhaps more dangerous for it. The thing about fascism is that it's inherently unstable. Because it's not a coherent ideology and it relies on vibes, it falls into all of these traps like the need to constantly have an enemy. And because it relies on propagandizing to paint a picture of reality that justifies the kind of actions that it wants to take, it's incapable of representing and therefore understanding reality accurately. I'm drawing, of course, on the essay Urfascism by Umberto Eco, which you can go and read in full. I'm not going to get into it. My point is that I think Eco's critique of fascism is correct, and his critique of fascism is that fascism cannot ultimately govern and cannot, in the main, win wars because tends to be incapable of understanding itself or its opposition, and that means that it's fundamentally unstable. You know what's really stable is feudalism. Now, when we say feudalism, we tend to think of like knights in armor and castles. Because even though we are strictly speaking ruled by King Charles, he doesn't actually have a lot of say day-to-day in the governing of our country by design, right? He has a proxy in the government, Governor General, and even the Governor General is not expected to like step in and do stuff and tell the government, you know, that they are or aren't allowed to do things. That's not how a constitutional monarchy works. An absolute monarchy, however, a feudal monarchy, that is something very different, but crucially, much more stable. Because as long as the king is reasonably competent and isn't toppled by an outside force, a monarchy can, a feudalist society can persist. I almost said monarchy, but monarchy and feudalism are not strictly speaking the same thing, can persist for, you know, hundreds, even thousands of years. The reason that I mention this is that it seems to me that the side of politics represented by the ACT Party, so we would call that sort of a right libertarianism, or maybe an extreme laissez-faire free market capitalism. The effect of that is to strip away functions from the government. And as that happens, the needs that those functions met don't disappear, right? If the government is providing unemployment benefits, as an example, that's meeting a need in the community, or they wouldn't do it. So if you strip that away, that need doesn't disappear. Now, you could say that the ACT Party just want the poor to die. But, what if what they want is for the poor to be put into a labor relationship where they can't do anything about the terms under which they labor? Because once you have that, what you have is something very like serfdom. And I think that's true when you look at the tendency to offload social needs onto charity, because the thing about charity, of course, is that it is usually funded at the discretion of the donor. So you give money to charities that you personally support, as opposed to just paying tax to the government, who spend it on based on policy, but, you know, fundamentally, like whatever the government decides is worthwhile. What that means is that you're in much more of a patronage relationship. We can come back to that word patronage again in a second. But I think if we allow ACT and their political stripe to get everything that they want, the direction that we go in is not so much fascist as it is feudal. And lest we forget, there are countries, I don't want to speak out of turn, because this runs the risk of being a white person commenting on other people's cultures. But there are countries which we deal with regularly which are semi-feudal in some ways. There are countries which were entirely feudal well into the 60s, 70s in South America. Feudalism is not something that necessarily belongs to the distant past. And the core concept of feudalism is that one person holds all of the power and sets all of the rules, and all work is done at the sufferance and for the benefit of that person. So serfs work the land and pay tax in kind to support the lord, and theoretically this is a reciprocal relationship where in turn they receive protection from other feudal entities from outside. And the appeal of this is that the king cannot commit crimes. The person who is at the top of the feudal pyramid literally defines law by their word or by their written word. And as a consequence, they can't break the law because they're the source of the law. The reason that this dovetails so neatly with a very structured version of the church is that it's a very similar relationship between like God and morality and the king and law, if you like. Now, there is another model that could work here, and I said we would come back to this word, and that would be patronage. Now, patronage was a semi-formal system that operated in ancient Rome. The idea of patronage is essentially that a rich man would be a patron and would take on a number of clients who were poorer people, who would do jobs and favors for them in return for various other benefits. Again, what it means is that power is very much, or social power is very much directly connected to money, and your access to social support and services is really contingent on your ability to please a specific rich and powerful person. You could also compare this to the paternalistic style of capitalism practiced by the sort of Christian reforming capitalists. There's a really good example of this. The book's called Sweet Delights and Captain's Thins, and it's a history of the Carr's Biscuit family, who began as a Quaker company, but were much more puritanical and controlling than we would associate with Quakers in the modern day. And so the original Mr. Carr, who built the Carr's Biscuit Factory, exercised this enormous amount of direct control over his workers. And because he was a Quaker, he by and large exercised that control in the direction of their economic and educational and, in his eyes, moral improvement. But actually, there was no necessary reason that he would have to do that. You know, I don't know. I think if you look at the history of capitalism, there is plenty of history of people, you know, running things like company towns with company stores. We have a similar level of control, just not the commitment to your workers' improvement that Mr. Carr had. And the important thing there is that in that situation, the power base, the power point, the capitalist in this case, but essentially the feudal ruler, has social and moral as well as financial control over their subjects. So they're not just saying you have to work for me, they're saying you have to live your life in accordance with my values. And I think if you look at what the ACT Party espouse, the end point is that you end up there. You end up with a series of probably corporate barons who exercise control over maybe their industries or maybe the areas that their industries operate in. And that control is very feudal in character. And if not feudal, it's maybe patronage, but, you know, why not both, right? It's perfectly plausible to imagine a society which at the bottom levels operates on a feudal basis, where you have bonded workers, serfs, if you like, who receive some degree of sustenance and protection in exchange for labor, although they're not actually paid and they cannot, there's no mechanism to rise from serfdom to any other level. And then at higher levels, you have people who are more comfortable but also more insecure, whose continued existence at any level of social relevance and power comes at the sufferance of a specific rich and powerful person who they're currying favor with. I think you can see a science fictional version of this in the better class of cyberpunk. There is certainly a lot of it in the ideas of the settings of things like Shadowrun, you know, the idea that corporations have supplanted governments and people become corporate citizens and depend for their entire livelihood as well as their legal protection on a for-profit corporate entity. So, finally, to return to fiction and talk about some of the things that I've been reading and the ways in which I find those interesting and think that they maybe offer us some antidotes. The first and most kind of on the nose, the one that I read the longest ago, is a novella from the collection by Cory Doctorow called Radicalized. Now, the whole collection is good. There are four novellas in it. I think the weakest is the one that deals with the idea of Superman being an illegal immigrant. Kind of, it's the one that I think holds up least well. But the one I want to talk about is called The Mask of the Red Death. The Mask of the Red Death is about a group of very rich techno-libertarians who hole up in a bunker. Now, incidentally, I am going to spoil these stories somewhat. So if you want to go and read them yourself, then you can pause the podcast and come back to it, and I will not be mad. If you're listening to this on the radio, you know, better luck next time. The Mask of the Red Death is about a group of kind of techno-libertarian wunderkind who hole up in a hyper-advanced bunker as the event approaches. And their assumption is that they're going to be able to wait out the event and then emerge as lords of the new apocalyptic wasteland, because they will have kept themselves in perfect health and have access to all of this incredibly powerful technology, and they will be able to bend the new world to their will and rebuild it from the ashes. And in fact, what happens is that all of them are horrible, insufferable people, and none of their stuff works the way that they want it to. And when they venture out into the outside world, they find that all of the people who are out there are much harder to deal with than they expect. And crucially, the thing that is happening off stage is that the people who are stuck in the terrible situation of the event, which is purposefully left kind of a blank slate, because it's not really the important part of the story, have been working together and finding ways to survive and to help each other. And so when they encounter this group of very small, very selfish people, they respond with a mixture of imperviousness to the threat that they offer, and I guess sort of bemusement more than anything, as these self-styled lords of the new world proceed to shit themselves to death in a bunker. That's, as I say, very on the nose, and there's a certain amount of wish fulfillment involved. But I think it's really important to remember that these people aren't as smart as they think they are, and the things that they set up never work as well as they intend. The next book that I want to talk about is one I read much more recently. It's called Sky Full of Elephants, and it's by a guy called Sibo Williams. I think that's how you pronounce his name. I've never seen it written down. So the pitch of a Sky Full of Elephants, and I'm going to tell you less about this one because I think there are some twists that are worth learning and some politics which I'm not really equipped to unpack because they're very specific in the way that they relate to American racial politics. It's not that in New Zealand we don't have racial politics, it's just that ours are different. The post-slavery thing in America really is its own unique bag of worms. And so anything that comes from that context always has a certain lack of applicability more broadly. But in brief, in A Sky Full of Elephants, the thing that happens before the novel, although we do get some flashbacks to it from the point of view of some particular characters, is that all at once, all over America, every white person walks into the nearest large body of water and drowns. And then the novel starts. And the events of the novel are interesting in a couple of ways. Firstly, the plot is a guy who has been in jail up until the event means that there is no one keeping anyone in jail anymore. He's been working as, I think, a high school physics teacher for a year when he receives a call out of the blue from a daughter that he didn't really know that he had, requesting assistance to get to a different town for reasons which are important in the plot, but I won't really go into. And a major part of the story early in their journey is about the way in which she expects the traditional, if you like, apocalypse of the war of all against all. But instead, with the exception of a few people who have been irrevocably mentally damaged by their experience of the event, most of the people that they meet are helpful and by and large trying to find ways of creating systems that will work in this new world and find ways to rebuild the institutional knowledge that was lost because, of course, the higher the level of institutional knowledge, the more likely it was for a white person to hoard that knowledge. And so there's a lot of like technical rediscovery and learning kind of happening on the fly all around them. And that's very interesting. And again, it really leans on that concept that if it all changes, we can look after each other. The other thing that's fascinating about that book, and an entire side note to this conversation, is that despite the entire inciting incident hinging on whiteness, the book does deal with the fact that whiteness is in fact fake. I know I referred to myself as white earlier. I just didn't want to digress into my whole whiteness is fake thing back then. Whiteness, we must remember, is a fake concept. You may have an ethnicity if you are a pale-skinned person, but that ethnicity is not white. White people do not come from anywhere. They do not have any culture. Here in New Zealand, you may be a Pakeha or a Palangi, or you may be an immigrant from another light-skinned, possibly English-speaking country, but none of those places are white. And none of those places generate white culture because there is no continuity in white culture from one place to another. That is, of course, beside the point, but it is interesting that despite the book hinging so tightly on that, that it manages to deal with that nuance as well. Anyway, that is all that I have for you. What you have been listening to in the background is something that might be for an upcoming project in May. If it comes to fruition, I will post about it on all of my various socials, and it may take the form of a video, so you may be able to watch various parts of it happen. We will see how that all pans out. Otherwise, it's just been a lovely little one-time bonus that you get to listen to and nobody else does. If you would like to hear this again or share it with a friend, obviously go ahead and do so. But in the meantime, really the core of my message is that these people don't want us to remember that we can look after one another, and the more that we do that, the less power they have. You've been listening to Reserved Recommendations, a radio show and podcast from Manawatū People's Radio, Te Reo Irirangi o ngā tangata o Manawatū. The show was produced and presented by me, Hugh Dingwall, and I also composed our theme music. It's called Sack Jazz, and you can find it at wolfboy.bandcamp.com. If you enjoyed this show, why not go ahead and share it with a friend? You can find the last 10 episodes of this show at npr.nz/show/reserved on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts. If you want an episode older than that, try searching for Reserved Recommendations on YouTube. You can find me at Objective Reality on Blue Sky, or send emails to objectivereality@gmail.com. You can also follow Reserved Recommendations on Facebook or Instagram. And finally, Manawatū People's Radio is a non-profit community access station. If you like this or any other piece of their fine audio programming, why not fling them a dollar or two? You can go to npr.nz/donate for more information on how to do that.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.